bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
What's up?
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Yo. Hi.
I got a question for you all. How do you know when you're half-assing it or you're working hard enough?
Oh, man. Put that one on my put that one on my gravestone. I don't know. All right. That's it for After Things, guys, because I don't have an answer for that one. I don't know. Now I'm thinking about it now. I have no idea.
I mean, I would imagine it's all about flow state. It's when you're lost in doing the thing, you're probably doing it as fast as you're able in that moment. If you're even able to ask the question, am I working hard enough? Then you probably haven't achieved that flow state, right?
But there's also pacing, right? You can't be in flow state 100% of the time.
I assume.
For example, season 2 of Raise the Dead. Want to do it. I've charted out what I'm reading. So now the question is, now that I know a little bit more about the process, what should I be doing? What is the pace I should be doing it at? Because part of it is that I have now is like, all right, I'll read until I kind of get bored of reading. And then if I'm listening to something, I want to be listening to other podcasts in that genre so I can just know, have a better sense of where the audience's expectation of quality is, right? So I'm not going in as blind as I was last time where I only listened to things that I liked. And then I made a product that I liked. Now that I feel more confident in my brand of the show, I want to listen to other things so I can just understand where I don't want to stop quality-wise. But even then, at what pace? How fast should I be going? When am I listening to too many things that I'm enjoying, you know, versus reading? How far is that being pushed back? Like, the alchemy of it is still foreign to me.
I give you an example. Nick, part of the reason I brought this up was I had somebody who would contact me. They'd been working on a book and they said, hey, my book's been out. My book hasn't been doing as well as I would like, though. And they spent a lot of time on the book. Books, you know, like full size, full length novel. And because my advice was like, yeah, start by launching on Amazon, you know, see things there, see your audience. And then they're like, yeah, that'd work. I'm thinking about like maybe hiring some people to help do a new version or whatever. And I went to go look at the Amazon page for the thing and the cover art for it. And if this person's listening, apologizing, I'm not going to use names. The cover art for it was horrific. It was literally like they took an image and then they dropped two other images on of them. One of them, they didn't even bother to like lasso cut. Right.
Yeah.
It was horrific. And I'm like, nobody's going to buy this from the look alone. Like we can't even speak to the quality of what you did, but it was like, and I was thinking about this and I know in this person's situation, like, cause I'm sympathetic. Cause like they spent all this time writing the book, probably a year, 2 years, whatever, writing the book, and they finished it. And then the first reaction they want to do is they just want to get it out there. And I'm like, for the love of God, go to 99 Designs, go to somewhere, pay $100, you know, buy a generic cover that you have the rights to, anything to be better. But in their mind, you know, the experiment failed, but they don't know why. And it may be because they're not a good writer. I don't know. But I've seen this repeatedly. I have friends in the publishing industry who go off and self-published, and then I see their final products and I'm like, this looks horrible. Like you got almost to the end, to the goal line, and then you just threw up on yourself.
I guess none of us have anything for that.
I will say this, that there is a bare minimum of aesthetics that needs to be met. And that is a lesson that I think is hard to learn. And it is a difficult lesson.
I guess it's not just the aesthetics part, is I know I'm making that mistake in parts of my life. I know there are things that I am doing and I'm not doing that other thing because I'm not aware of it. I don't know what that is. And I've, like I said, I've seen books from people who should know better, and I pick up the book and like it's formatted wrong. And I'm like, and I think in some cases, I know some of those people, they are just, you can't tell them, they're immune to it. They don't want there to, I guess maybe the part of the problem is you don't want to reach a point where you then shut off all criticism. And I think that's maybe a danger, is maybe there's a point where we're the most vulnerable is when we need to hear it the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, back to the original question, how do you know when you're working? I don't know. It sounds like we're talking about kind of two different issues here.
What was half-assing it? I said, how do you know when you're half-assing it or whatever? And that's kind of the point was like,
it's okay. Tough because I'm actually a fan of half-assing things, insofar as half-assed things tend to get done, whereas perfect things very rarely get done. So it's like, I don't want to bag on half-assing it, because in general, if you're half-assing it, you're at least doing it.
Well, let's qualify that though, because like, person writes a book, which is great, and that book probably could use editing a lot of things. But the problem is that like there's a point where you half-ass it too much. Like, I recorded a podcast on a freeway, you know, with a bunch of cars driving by, and I put it out there. Hey, I'm doing things. Like, maybe that's a little too much half-assed.
Yeah, I guess there's got to be somewhere between perfect is the enemy of good, which is I think what Brian's point is, and that is well made. And like, all right, but you got to show up. Like, you have to show up to work with pants on, right? Like there is some lesson where it's like, okay, minimum requirements do exist in some of these fields.
But you know, oddly enough, for the three of us, none of us have to show up with pants on.
That is a good point. Yeah, no, that is a good point.
Well, and also, you know, I think there's a difference between like effort and amount of time spent, because it did originally sound like we were kind of talking about pacing in terms of if you're half-assed or working hard enough.
Yeah.
But you could spend 100 hours on whatever that book cover the book cover you were describing, Andrew, and whether it's a technical thing that they just don't have the skills and that's the best thing that they can put together, you know, it's also not just, you know, working harder, but also working smarter and trying to, I guess, keeping an eye out for things that others maybe aren't responding as well to, and seeing like in that case where you could outsource or you know, reach out, consult with someone else about a design or an element of your process.
Okay. So you used a very good phrase there, which is working smarter. And I think that's one of the things that like Brian, like, cause I completely agree with you. Like, you, if you try to make perfect, you'll never get anything done. And once I said, I just want to write good books, that made my life easy. If I said I was going to write great books, I'd never release anything. And I 100% believe in what you said there, that you can't say, I got to wait till it's perfect. But there, you are very open to feedback loops. You put stuff out there. You're like, tell me what you think. Tell me what you think. Tell me what you think. And I think that's one of the things that's missing sometimes in processes. I think in some of mine is I don't want people to tell me what they think because I'm afraid. And then I end up not making something as well as it could be. And I would say that might be kind of you find a half ass, but also have a space to find out what you need to do to make it better. Or that's the how to work smarter. Is like, I made a thing. Now, how do I make the thing better? And how do I get that feedback? How do I get that information?
Yeah, I wish I had any idea as to what that dividing line is. I really don't, though, because I agree. It's something that only you can know for yourself. And there definitely is a two sides of the line, but for the life of me, I wouldn't be able to tell anybody.
Well, yeah, but
you definitely told me on Raise the Dead.
Yes, but that was that was just a gut reaction. I don't have any sense of a hard and fast rule, right? Like,
well, it's the forest for the trees. Both of you, I think, have very good processes, and it's so inborn to you, you don't even think about it. Like I said, Brian, like, you ask for input. You go, what do I need to do next on this? You look at YouTube comments and stuff, and you say, okay, how do I use this to improve? You read emails. That's your process, and that's so natural to you. The thing is, a lot of people don't do that. A lot of people, they make a thing, and they want to push it out into the world at the point that all they want from the world now is just the praise, not the how do I make it better? And I would say that's the missing link there, is the idea of, here's the thing. It's here. I, I, I know it. My knowledge stops here. Now I need the knowledge from other people to make it better.
Yeah. I would say that's a fair analysis, in that I don't perceive that anything is ever done. Everything is just whatever the latest iteration is. You know, if we don't get it right this particular episode of Scam Nation or Mono Rogue or whatever, then we'll try to get closer to getting it right next time.
So I would say then, that just helped clarify for me, because I think that's like the big dividing line, is that there are the people who go like, okay, now tell me how to make it better. Those are the ones that exceed and do tremendously. The ones that say, hey, I've made the thing, now tell me how great I am. Those are the ones that suffer because they miss out on the most important process, which is the feedback cycle. Sure. So that's helpful. So let's go to the other issue, which was the pace. Like, yeah, how hard should we be working?
Man, that's tough. That's tough because I am a burster by nature. And I think that it ate away at me for a very long time. And in fact, I'm trying to be better at being a plotter over a burster. And I don't feel qualified to really chime in on this because all I've done is burst and I've seen it hollow me out from the inside.
Let me ask you this also, Brian, because I think your fundamental change now is that you are now the leader of an organization and like a group. You can be a group of bursters, right? But if you're doing an organization, which will only get further and further away from you, you need to set an example of plotting, right? Like you need to say, hey, look, it'd be great if everybody could burst all the time and we could all blast through these goals faster. But at minimum, you need to plod. And that means that because all organizations eventually take the personality of their leader, that's something that you need to find in yourself if you want to impart onto other people.
Yeah. And especially because bursting almost as a certainty, you as a individual will not happen to be bursting when everybody else wants to be bursting. So it's not helpful for you to kick in the door and be like, I'm ready to burst, and nobody else is there on there. And by nature, plotting means that you have to show up when you don't feel like showing up and so on.
So how has that process gone?
I'm still learning. I'm working on it. Well, what are you, a cop? You know, you have to say if you're a cop.
So I'm going to read from that work in progress.
Very much so. Very much so.
I'd say the Brian Brushwood on this show now is very different from 4 or 5 years ago when I first started here, in terms of the taking that bursting energy and directing it in various places.
I guess if there's any achievement that's happened over the last 4 or 5 years, it's been figuring out how to bottle up that energy and, I don't know, pickle it, for lack of a better word. Zia says that some amount of it will be there when we need it.
Using it productively.
Yeah.
Which is funny, though, because I think, Brian, so much of your life was lived on someone else's schedule. And really the existence that you have now is an extrapolation of the free time that you had while you weren't being told where to go. And granted, it wasn't the show up every day 9 to 5 of Dell, but now all of a sudden that you had the Touring Magic show, it was just like dates fall out of the sky, right? And you hustle for those, and then you work your life around. And now the life you have is a professionalization of what used to be the time in between. Would that be a fair description?
100%. Now we've reached the bizarre level where there was a gig proposal that came up and I had to say no. At that amount of money, I'm not allowed to go do this because it's an earthquake to the whole organization. It takes me out of the loop for 2 days. I would love to emotionally, I would love to for my sense of self-esteem, but I can't in good conscience do the gig. And so,
yeah, sorry, Johnny. Ryan's not going to do your birthday party.
That's of like at some point you're just like, no, I'm not in the business of saying yes to that anymore.
But also it's like you created a personal life and a structure of hobbies that were there to benefit yourself professionally. But we're also there because you enjoyed them, right? And now you are in the very weird transition of professionalizing that. Like, what used to be the professional part now is no longer. And now everything that you have was built from, hey, I want to have a studio in my house and I want to have virtual friends, or I want to be able to capture the scam school stuff, or I want to make scam school more my own, right? And I want to do it on my schedule and not be flown out.
Yeah, it's doubly difficult because now I have to do the really hard work of internalizing the reality of what we're up to now. Like, for the first 5 years that you and I would hop on a webcam and try to make the comedy show, it felt to some degree like we were play pretending at being comedians. And then now we're doing the hard work of internalizing, no, wait, we're actual award-winning, money-making comedians. And you have to have, balance. The internal world has to match the outward reality. And that's more work than I would have expected it to take.
I still haven't internalized the idea that I'm a writer.
Right?
That's crazy.
That is crazy.
I like to write and I do what my publisher says, do some edits, do this thing like this, but I still don't like still have imposter syndrome. I still go through all of that and you know.
Yeah.
Weird.
Imposter syndrome, something that has been very weird for me because on some level I am terrified to speak to other people that are theoretically my peers. But on the other hand, I don't feel that I'm not one of them. and if anything, I very much feel that like that fraudulence reigns. And even if I am a fraud, I am only one of many that creates the entire whole.
Yeah. Yeah. I was at a conference or one of these writing conferences there, and my publisher put together a little cocktail party where I'd meet some of the other writers there, and I'm talking to these other people and I'm like, wow, like these are real writers.
Yeah.
You know, and like I go into the banquet and my book is on every table because it was one of these awards things like this, and I'm like, but I still in my head I'm like,
what?
I'm a pretender, you know.
Honestly, this is the thing that I thought about all weekend because I'm going to Iowa in 2 weeks, and then New Hampshire, and then Nevada, and then based on the projection of the Patreon, I'll probably wind up going to South Carolina. But I've found myself like, I just want to. I was talking to Andrew Heaton, and I'm like, dude, you got to come to one of these things. I just need friends. Like, I feel like I'm like the new kid in school. Like I'm going to go and I'm not going to know anybody and all these cliques are going to be there. So I'm just like calling, I'm like emailing everyone that I know. And I'm like, hey, will you hang out with me? Like, I just want to have somebody that like just shows me the ropes. I'm going to this like reporter high school thing that I'm terrified of. Now, I very much think I should be there. I very much am looking forward to creating the content there, but I also know that part of this is a networking thing for which I am totally unprepared and terrified of.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Like, how do you begin? How do you break into that crowd? I guess the closest thing I could think of is when I started going to the college booking conferences. And, you know, I had no right to be there. I didn't know anybody. I wasn't established. But I guess at the end of the day, you can always be the friendliest guy there. You can always be the one who's most interested in what other people have to say, the best listener, and so on.
We're going to see. We're going to find out, man, because I'm definitely going to hang. I mean, it's not like I don't know some people. I'll know. I don't know, guys. I'm scared.
Here's so I've done a couple of these meetups, like the NASA social events where you go to, you know, do be part of a social media thing, go there. And the thing that I'd realized a couple years ago is like, my nature is I can be extremely extroverted or extremely introvert. I think we're all like that. It's just flip a switch. one, you know, switch is on. Hey, everybody, flip the switch. All right, now I'm in my own world. And I went the first time I went to one, I'm like, you know what? I bet everybody feels like I do. Most, like, you might see some people know each other, whatever, but there are far more people feeling like outsiders than insiders.
Yeah.
So the first thing I would do is I just look for a couple interesting people. Hey, I'm Andrew. How are you doing? Like, oh, who are you? Whatever. Do you know anybody here? Like, no, well, hey guys. And I'd form a little cluster. And I did that. Yeah. The first time I did that, the group of us, you know, we did watched a lot. We went to Disneyland. We've stayed in touch forever. I went and did another one of those earlier this year. And I did the same thing, found a group of people. We all talked, whatever. And we just formed a cluster. And then we became the fun group, you know? And that's the thing that happens is it wasn't one of these fake, like, hey, everybody, let's be, it's like, hey, how are you doing? I don't know anybody. Oh, you're cool. Let's hang out. I'm like, hey, let's go grab dinner together. Let's go meet here. And that was sort of my way, was like in a very sincere, like, hey, I don't know anybody. You guys seem interesting or whatever. Let's just hang out.
I agree. No, there's nothing that you've said that is incorrect. Everything you said is totally 100% true. And the big key here, to be totally honest, the big thing that does warm me is focusing on the work. Is just like thinking about, like, all right, you want to know what? At the end of the day, the one thing that I know will make me so much more in my own, in my own world and comfortable enough to think about those social dynamics is focusing on the work, knowing that, like, I got something good out. I'm serving the audience. They're going to enjoy it. And I feel happy about that. And if I can do that, then I will be much better at making friends.
You know, for many of us, hearing Justin Robert Young talk about kind of social anxiety or issues about making friends is like hearing Donald Trump has insecurities about or doesn't feel confident.
Yeah. Like, Andrew knows. I mean, Andrew's known me since I was in high school. I've always been an insecure person on some level. But also, it's like there are elements where it's like, oh, okay, well, if you create your own little world and you're inviting to people to be a part of it, then that does aid in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and I think that you, some groups are defined by what they're not or by being judgmental. But if we created a really neat community and we started iTrix.
Yep.
You know, because we're like, we said, you know, there's so much of this cliquishness and this bitchiness in magic, and we don't want that. We don't want that. We want to be a positive, hey, we love this. Let's talk about what we love. Let's, as the kind of leaders of the community, let's downplay any people going negative and stuff. And sometimes emailing people like, hey, I know you're a good guy, but you said this thing and people won't perceive it this way, whatever. We've had those conversations with people like, hey, like, here's how to get along with everybody, not let's, you're an enemy kind of thing. And it worked out pretty well. And I think what you guys have done with, Diamond Club, NSFW show and all that, and Night Attack, you know, through the ages, what you guys done, if you created this community of people and say, like, we're all a bunch of weirdos. We're all outsiders sitting at home, staring at our internet, you know, looking for something to do. We acknowledge that, accept that, and we accept you.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, it's so funny because, like, I'm hearing Andrew's words and I'm like, yes, they're 100% true. And then I see Justin's face and I'm like, yeah, that doesn't make it any easier to go out and make new friends.
Look, I mean, this is all good. This is all fun and games, and everybody's gonna be doing good. And then I'm gonna be at that Marriott bar. Yep, in Des Moines.
No, I understand that there's a difference between the 1,000-foot view, the real time strategy game, and the first person shooter. Like you know that you're gonna be in that first person shooter experience and it's gonna suck.
I'm gonna get that show done and it's gonna be great. I'm gonna feel good about myself, and then I'm gonna be like, all right, I gotta go network. I definitely shouldn't just sit here in this hotel room and go to sleep. I should definitely go and network. That's why I'm here. If I want to continue to make myself somebody in politics, then I gotta go. I gotta go to where I know people are there. And then I'm gonna go there and I'm gonna have friends that we can either matriculate and they're gonna know, or I'm gonna get that bottle of Bud Light and I'm just gonna be like, ah, ah, ah.
So the term networking has always frustrated me, because you know, I've experienced the worst side of it, that pressure of like, ah, you got to go here, network. And it's like, so I go around and introduce myself to 20 people and hope something happens. Like, that's like as demoralizing as doing close-up magic for people who don't want to see it. And my approach is like, I don't network. I'll go to a party and I'll talk to the nearest person to me and talk to them and talk to a couple other people and have nice conversations. If there's somebody super interesting there or whatever, but I haven't talked to them, fine, but I'm not going to go try to go do that, because whenever I do, I always walk home feeling, Uber home feeling empty and shallow. But if I just go like, hey, let me just talk, meet a couple interesting people, talk to the person who's maybe, and I found that sometimes, like, I've gone to some, because I get invited to some cool parties in LA, and sometimes the least interesting person who I'll just talk to, I find out is the most interesting person in the room, you know, because, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't, I say, like, forget networking, like, hey, there are a couple of people like, yeah, just go hang out with them and not put the pressure on.
I'm not thinking about like, oh, well, I mean, who am I going to talk to that takes my career to the next level? Yeah. Like, it is more just talking to those other people and.
Yeah, I mean, don't network, but do go to the bar and hang out.
I mean, I don't know, to some degree, and keep in mind, I'm the least qualified person to speak to this because I've spent the least amount of time single of anyone on the panel, but it feels like dating. Like, you don't go out and intend to meet the one, just go out and meet a one, because don't try to meet the person that is the right one. Meet the person who down the road will introduce you to the person that's the right one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where I'm like 50%. Well, now I'm, because we've been talking about it, it's growing. It's like 50% now. In general, I'm not too worried about it because I do know a few people. Like, yeah. I I'm DMing. I'm gonna make sure. Like, when I went to Politicon, I was very happy because I knew a few people that were there. And I had Heaton, and then I wound up meeting other people that I had met through BitTorrent. So, like, I had a little, like, I could do the anybody who's been to convention knows that you have that text rundown, right? You have, like, the one person, and then you see what they're up to, and then you text a few other people. I got like two or three people I can text, and that I'm happy about. That makes me a lot happier. Now, if they stop responding to me, I will immediately panic and probably fly home crying.
Yeah. Well, we're used to that. The reason we're here is because at a conference, Brian struck up a conversation with me.
Yep.
You know? And it was, and I don't think, Brian, you were trying to meet everybody or network at there. It was like, you know, we were both young guys doing, that's how long ago it was, doing similar stuff in the same sort of area. And Brian's like, ah, we'll talk. We started talking about that and stayed in touch. And then, you know, next thing you know.
Yeah. Here we are. There's, this is something that is talked about in the book, The Formula. He talks about, when performance can't be measured, network effects determine success or whatever. Those loose, weak connections really, really matter. So, like, that's one of the nice things is it reduces the stakes. It's not like you have to find your next collaborator for, you know, for a Time Life set of 13 books. You just have to find somebody that you kind of know so that when you have a question, oh, wait, who do I know that knows that person comes to mind?
Yep, that's a great point. All right, any picks?
I finally got my kid to watch Firefly. So I just this morning watched the first episode of Firefly, 90 minutes long. Still holds up. So it's a little bit, I think we rewatched it for Cord Killers a little while ago, and its low budgetness shows a bit more after nearly 20 years. But the storytelling and the characters, very worthy.
Hey, Bryce, how would you describe the cast?
I think that they've all aged 1 year per year since the show came out almost 20 years ago.
Oh, this is...
I went and read that email, by the way.
I
feels like a disproportionate.
Exactly. Yeah, you got to tell everyone the story.
I don't even remember it. That's the funny thing.
Bryce levied a fiery critique to the most adorable cast member, calling her a bitter old hag.
Tom Merritt said the entire cast is too old to come back for a revival. I think maybe that's what reports tell me.
And you said specifically that Jewel State character.
Yeah, I think pouring gasoline on the fire was the metaphor that was used. Firefly, the visual effects maybe not holding up so much?
Not so much the visual effects, but the practical effects. Like, there's a lot of times that with fresh eyes, you're able to say, that's a golf cart with a bunch of, like, plastic things taped to it.
Well, it is a secondhand sort of, you know, space civilization, you know, Brian, maybe it is supposed to be a golf cart with a bunch of stuff.
Maybe.
You know what? I have to go back and rewatch it. But like, it was one of the shows people talked about at the time, and I'm like, I'm not gonna end that into this thing. And then, you know, when I sat down to watch it, I really, really liked the way that world it built. I loved that universe. I liked the characters, and I thought, you know, to me, it was like Joss Whedon doing, you know, some of it. Joss Whedon taking a medium that's been overdone and tropish, and going in there and doing something really fun and fresh with the characters and what goes on there, and I enjoyed it. Like, I really like, you know, between, you know, the Mal character, Adam Baldwin's character, whatnot. Like, they were just the funny twists that they would go into were just great. So, you know, there's every now and then there's talk of a revival. And unlike some people, like, you know, I don't know the full availability of everybody there, but I would love that universe to be brought back.
Well, we talked about it because there were mysterious tweets as Fox programming people were giving keynotes, and so they said the thing that they always say, which is, yes, we do own Firefly, and wouldn't it be great if that made some money again? Which, wouldn't it be great?
And I guess Tim Minear is the producer on that, which, you know, we could see. You know, we didn't come together. We'd be cool.
So,
you know, that franchise keeps going. There's like an audio, there's a couple books out now too that take place in that world.
Cool.
One of the things that I've been trying to do for Raise the Dead is listen to other audio history series or popular podcast series. In general, one of the things that I'm not a massive fan of, I know, is a very popular trope, largely because of the influence of This American Life, is the idea that your narrator is the real star of the story and that you are brought in through the narrator's motivations. And I think that there's a certain element that is expected of that. And I certainly used a little bit of that at the beginning of Raise the Dead just to explain why the listener should care about it. But sometimes I think it can get a little overindulgent. End sentence, end paragraph, save document, close program, shut down computer, reboot computer, open new document. I've been listening to Dolly Parton's America. And let me just say this. I think that there is very much a justification for doing, I think it's like a 9-part series on Dolly Parton. Dolly Parton is a fascinating figure, a trailblazer. She is every facet that they are describing. And that's my review. I like all those elements.
it sounds like a documentary now.
You know, I started a channel on my Discord because I realized that if I start putting my opinions on Twitter, I'm going to start burning bridges in a field I have literally just entered before I have a chance to even talk to anybody and go forward. So, but Dolly Parton, they do a lot of interviews with Dolly. She is amazing. And there are great, great, great parallels of why Dolly Parton and really country music has transcended the world. How much of a common story country music tends to capture of the immigrant story and a poor a struggle and a struggle to be free, but also understand your pain. And that is something that a lot of the world, there's a reason why country music is a global phenomenon, because so much of the world understands that, you know, and that's great.
These also
are great things.
Jad Abumrad gonna have a fight with Justin Robert Young at the Bayou just after after school.
Nope.
Come on.
Nope. I've only said positive things about about Dolly Parton's America. That's all I've said.
Yeah. I'm curious about that. I love Dolly Parton. I love her story, you know, and just, you know, what she's been able to build, everything like that, how she started. You know, she was not beloved when she first started, because she was like the partner in a country music act where she replaced like the favorite, and then she was the new one and wasn't well liked. And then when she went to do her solo career, people advised against it and stuff. And it's just
there's a great the series does seem to alternate between straight description of the very colorful, amazing life of Dolly Parton, and then these larger kind of themes. Why does Dolly Parton, you know, one of the things that the first episode gets to is the co-opting of Dolly Parton as a feminist icon, and whether or not Dolly herself thinks of herself as a feminist icon. Spoiler alert, she shoots it down immediately. And so they kind of sew together the gulf between those ideas, and I think that those are great. That these are great, great ideas.
Yeah. Totally unrelated. Bryce.
I gotta think. Did anybody here ever watch a live action show called Children's Hospital?
No.
Adult Swim channel.
Uh-uh.
Maybe the spin-off NTSF SDSUV, the sort of CSI-like parody show. No? So that entire crew just got just put together a new Netflix show called Medical Police. This is actually canonically a part of the Children's Hospital universe. It starts off even in Children's Hospital in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And it follows two of the doctors who are on the staff of the hospital there, who get wrapped up into this whole viral outbreak and end up traveling, quote unquote, the world and visit international locales that are not just Pasadena with color filters. to track down this virus and save the world, and it's a lot of like very non sequitur sort of humor, very a little random, kind of dumb in a lot of places, but I think it's neat. You know, it's weird because it is kind of a semi serialized story. They're mostly trying to solve this one case in this series, or in this, I guess, this season, but it's fun. And I think if you remember, or if you like any of the people, Rob Corddry is the creator on it. Aaron Hayes and Rob Hubel are the stars, and they are both fantastic in this, as I thought they were in Children's Hospital.
And I think this is directed by David Wayne.
He's a creator. I think there are different directors, if I'm not mistaken.
From what I have not seen a lot of it, but from what I've heard it described, if you like Wet Hot American Summer is another David Wayne. David Wayne was one of the members of the state. So Stella, Wet Hot American Summer are examples of his work.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is that same, you know, almost like slapsticky on some level, a lot of like characters just being intentionally obtuse, or the random like a joke for the sake of pattern interruption. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's on Netflix. I think it's 10 episodes. Yeah, 10 half-hour episodes on Netflix.
Nice.
Andrew?
My pick is a, you know, I tend to, when I write code, I tend to like watch, you know, just YouTube videos, find a bunch of YouTube stuff to watch to play in the background. And I watched a series by, I think he calls the channel The Company Man. And he does these kind of 10, 12 minute, 15 minute deep dives into stories of different companies and how they got their origins. I'll ask you guys a question. Mm-hmm. What does Arby's stand for?
Arby's? Like their values?
The name. Where does the name come from?
Oh, I know this. I did big old hat.
Bryce thinks he knows it, but Bryce doesn't know
I
it.
I do know it. I think I do.
Justin, all right, Bryce, what do you let's think?
Oh, I got no idea.
See, a lot of people might think it stands for roast beef, but I think it's the name of the brothers, the Damn last name of the brothers who Bryce. Founded it, right?
Damn it, Bryce. You're right. Yeah, I'm like, no, Bryce doesn't know it. Bryce did it. Yeah, like the Raffle brothers, the two brothers that started it. 100% Bryce. Again, you surprised me. but yeah, because people hear RB, roast beef, and then like mm-hmm. no, it's the Rabble Brothers, you know, RB. But yeah, so Company Man is neat. Goes into these dives and, again, what happened to this company, the rise and fall of these companies. And so he does these really neat kind of, you know, examinations and stuff. And it's kind of a neat way to kind of look into behind these brands and stuff. And, you know, he just, you know, a lot of, you know, kind of, you know, internet research goes through there and tries to find, you know, the different sorts of, you know, somebody said this, somebody said that. And that's what I liked is was a little bit deeper like that, like. If you had asked me this question 2 days ago, I would have got it wrong, Bryce. Like, it's roast beef, you know? And then I watched this, and now you killed my chance at smugness. Thank you. it goes like to eBay. Like, oh, how did eBay get its start? And a lot of the times, it's a very good example of how, like, you'll hear the story like, oh, eBay got its start because this guy wanted to help his wife sell her, like, Pez collector, his girlfriend sell her Pez yeah. collection and stuff. And after you read enough biographies and stuff and you listen to ones where they do original resource and you start to realize how much of what we know, and they go, oh, everybody says this was, yeah, an article was written in 1995 and 10 other people quoted that article, mentioned that article or mentioned it without quoting where it came from. And now it's become the truth, but it's not, you know, or it's one version of something. And anyhow, I liked it because he does a little bit deep, digs a little bit deeper to get some of the more stuff in there. So Company Man is my pick on YouTube.
Very cool.
Nice.
Nice. Gentlemen, it's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.